Hi everyone, I am Professor Carrie Lynn Nankivell of Daniel K. Inouye Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies, and I'm really happy this morning to talk about a very important topic related to our current in-resident course, Comprehensive Crisis Management, and one that relates specifically to the maritime domain, and that is irregular migration by sea. I'm going to talk a little bit about both the context and some responses that have already been put in place by state actors as a way to open a discussion about an increasingly relevant and difficult subject in Asian international relations. And I should say right up front that the issue of irregular migration at sea is not one that the regional or international community is equipped to handle very well. And while I'm going to offer some models of state response by way of illumination, I am not trying to put value judgments on the responses that are already in place. It is my perspective that no state or coalition of states is dealing with irregular migration at sea very effectively. And the fact that we're left flat-footed in dealing with an increasingly important reality of our regional security environment makes it all the more important that we look at it in detail and start to explore ways that we can get better. So it's with that perspective in mind that I'm going to offer you my remarks this morning. So let's start by considering the issue. So when we think about irregular migration at sea, there are a lot of different frames that we can apply to phenomena. And I use the words irregular migration as a way to cast a really wide net in terms of thinking about who is moving over the seas, by what means, and for what purpose. And the fact that so many people use the maritime domain for so many purposes, both licit and illicit, means that it's hard to nail down a particular way of thinking and talking about irregular migration, and that's part of the challenge. But in my mind, if we want to start a conversation, we can put irregular migration at sea into two very large baskets. The first, and the one that gets the most political attention, specifically in recent years, is we can think about irregular migration at sea as being a humanitarian crisis. And you may be familiar with the image on the slide, which is a very difficult image, so I apologize up front if it takes anybody by surprise. It is a photo that's come to be described as the Kurdi incident, which is the family name of the child who died in this incident. And it was taken in September of 2015 and reported by an English newspaper out of the UK called The Independent. Now, if you remember, September 2015 was a particularly difficult month on the northern shores of the Mediterranean. It was really, in some ways, the apex of a very difficult year. At that time, a number of events in the Middle East had led to the large-scale movement of populations from a variety of places that were converging on the Mediterranean as an easy access point to Europe. Now, that sort of trend had been building for a couple of years and had reached kind of a climax point in 2015, but it was this photo of the Kurdi incident that really changed the way that the general public framed and discussed the issue of irregular migration across the Mediterranean. Because the politics of irregular migration changed, it also changed the objectives that governments set to address the trend of increasing population flows, and then, of course, changed their operational response. So this photo really marked a turning point where politics and political change was quickly translated into a change strategy and operational activity by not just law enforcement, but militaries in the southern Mediterranean. And importantly, it didn't necessarily change the strategy in ways that we would expect when we think about humanitarian crisis. And I'll talk about that in a little more detail when I discuss the state response. But first, let's look a little bit at the data behind the humanitarian crisis in the Mediterranean in 2015. So as you can see from the chart on the bottom of the slide, 2015 was a particularly difficult year. So the southern Mediterranean, which we're primarily talking about Greece, Italy, and Spain, to a lesser extent France, saw more than a million arrivals. And those were the ones that, of course, were recorded. And that translated into a high point in October of 2015, where over 200,000 people were recorded landing in unconventional ways in southern Europe across the Mediterranean. We also saw through 2015, and that's displayed on the map in the top right-hand corner of the slide, a distinct geographical shift in terms of the migratory routes that would-be refugees or asylum seekers were exploiting. So when Mediterranean migration first came on the radar of security agencies in Europe, it was in the mid-2000s, around 2006, and at that time the primary vulnerable routes were on the West African or West Mediterranean route, that is, landings in southern Spain and coming from West African source countries or transit countries. By 2014 and 15, in large part because of the chaos created by the Arab Spring, which had hardened into a couple of very entrenched civil conflicts, including in Syria and in Libya, the central Mediterranean route, particularly the routes from Libya to southern Italy and from Turkey into Greece, became widely exploited, not just by people from those conflict-affected countries, but also people from countries much farther away, like sub-Saharan Africa, and even into Western Asia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Nepal. There was such a huge number of people moving through those routes at that time that it became an easy opportunity for lots of different kinds of people to seek access to European shelter for one reason or another, whether it was fleeing civil war or just looking for better economic opportunities or something in between. I can't recommend this website enough. There's a link on the bottom bottom of the slide. It's data provided by the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, and that data is updated regularly. So if you want to see the latest on the refugee crisis in the Mediterranean or elsewhere, this is an excellent resource. The point, I guess, that I'm trying to make is that if we think about irregular migration as culminating in a humanitarian crisis, which is certainly the way we started talking about Syrian refugees in particular across the Mediterranean in 2015, we'll see in the case studies later in the lecture that this humanitarian aspect of the crisis has largely remained unaddressed, and there is still a large amount of human movement across maritime spaces, oftentimes at great personal danger and resulting in what many would agree is an unacceptable level of fatalities, and for which the international community and the regional community hasn't yet mounted a very satisfactory response. So even though we're seeing the number of transits go down dramatically as a result of robust law enforcement and military operation through 16 and 2017, we're actually seeing that the transits are increasingly dangerous. So fewer people are trying the transit, but among those who do try, a greater percentage, by about a factor of three, are dying en route. Okay, so we know that irregular migration can contribute to, and often does contribute to, a humanitarian crisis. But there's another perspective, which is very important, equally legitimate, and in a lot of ways much more acceptable and palatable to state actors that are confronting the large movement of people, oftentimes in very short time span. And I put this under the very large heading of a sovereignty crisis. And when I say sovereignty crisis, I'm sure that at least some of you listening, when you're hearing that a million people arrive in southern Europe within the space of 12 months, or 200,000 people arrive in a single country like Greece in the course of 1 month, a sovereignty crisis is a natural way to receive and frame that kind of information. And that is the recognition that while one refugee is not a threat to a state's overall capacity and integrity, the arrival of hundreds of thousands of refugees in a short time span clearly is a challenge to law and order. It's a challenge to border security. It may even be perceived as a challenge to national identity. And we're certainly seeing that kind of political reaction, not just in Europe, but in lots of places that have experienced large refugee flows in recent times. And that idea that that irregular migration is a crisis of sovereignty is one that has really motivated various state actors to take robust action to address refugee flows or irregular migratory flows in some unusual ways. I don't want to, as some in the humanitarian community sometimes fault states for overly focusing on the sovereignty threat associated with irregular migrants and not privileging the humanitarian crisis enough. I don't want to also fall into that trap of making it seem as though this phenomenon is only one kind of threat and not another. The reality is that it's both a humanitarian crisis and a sovereignty crisis packaged into one, and that's what makes it so hard to deal with. And we've certainly seen in past that large migration flows and even legitimate refugees can and do present a security threat to the receiving country. And the two pictures on the slide are only two examples. I'm not even sure they're the best examples, but they're ones that I think most of you will be familiar with already. The first shows a border wall that was constructed, is being constructed along the Afghan-Pakistan border, which is of course very porous, and the porousness of that border has long been cited by both academics and practitioners as being a partly contributing factor to the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan, in the sense that there is freedom of movement across the border, which frustrates the authorities' ability to police and get their arms around both insurgent groups, terrorist groups, and of course transnational criminal groups. And so, you know, that presents not just a policing challenge for both Pakistan and Afghanistan, but it also presents a military challenge, a direct threat certainly to the authorities in Kabul trying to contend with the reality that the border is more an idea than a reality. The other photo is much older, but is also a well-cited example of where large refugee populations created security problems for the receiving country and for the destination country. That photo is a refugee camp that was established in the eastern Congo in 1994. The people that came to that refugee camp were all fleeing genocide in Rwanda, and as a result, they used this base not just as a place to gain humanitarian relief, but also as a place to plan counterattacks back into Rwanda to regain control after the genocidal conflict that took place there. Eventually, after 1994, Eastern Congo became deeply destabilized by Rwandan refugees that brought their civil war and their internal concerns to Congolese soil. And today, Congo continues to be the site of the world's largest United Nations peacekeeping mission, in part because of the security challenges. And only in part, but in part because of the security challenges that were brought to Congo by refugees fleeing conflicts in their home countries. So irregular migration can and does present a very real sovereignty crisis to national authorities in lots of places, and any ideal response is going to need to contend with that reality as well as with the reality of the humanitarian concerns and the large-scale loss of life, which we're also very familiar with. Okay, so those two big frames or baskets of that can help us wrap our minds around what irregular migration means and what kind of threat it presents, and therefore give us some boundaries around what kind of operational responses states can and should design in response. I'm going to add one third possible frame, which I think addresses some of the tension between the humanitarian and the sovereignty concerns, and hopefully will help clarify some of our thinking about it. And that's to suggest that when thinking about irregular migration flows, it's important not to remember or not to forget that this is also a crisis of governance. And the crisis of governance is particularly acute in the maritime domain because of the nature of sovereignty and the legal instruments that we've designed as a human community to order our behaviors at sea. So in order to illustrate this, I've put a very crude diagram on the slide. It shows the maritime jurisdictions from the beach of a sovereign territory. And it also shows the parties that are involved in the irregular migration in irregular migration. So in terms of the maritime zone, the farthest, the most left-hand zone on the slide is the territorial sea. And it's marked from 0 to 12 nautical miles. And in the territorial sea, state authorities have full sovereignty. So any laws that apply on land, including laws related to immigration, customs, criminal jurisdiction, what have you, apply in the territorial sea just as they apply on the beach or much farther inland. So what we might call that the zone of maximum sovereignty. From 12 to 24 nautical miles, we have a zone called the contiguous zone. Now, the contiguous zone is one in which state authority is much weaker and more diffuse than it is from 12 nautical miles landward. So in the contiguous zone, the coastal state does have some powers, but not all. The powers that they do retain from 12 to 24 nautical miles do include immigration, for example, customs, and sanitation, but they do not include criminal jurisdiction. So crimes, quote unquote, committed in the contiguous zone are not prosecutable by the coastal state on one side of 12 nautical miles, even while they are on the other. And beyond that, you have two further zones. One is the exclusive economic zone, and then, of course, beyond that is the high seas, otherwise known as areas beyond national jurisdiction. Now, because the exclusive economic zone, which most of you will be familiar with, is what it sounds like, that is a zone related only to economic or profit-making activity, it's actually not a relevant factor when considering irregular migration at sea and coastal state jurisdictions. What you do have then beyond 24 nautical miles is high seas, in which every state and every person has free access and the right to free movement, particularly to pursue activities that are not threatening to any coastal state. So you basically have those three zones. On the top of the slide, I've got the three stakeholders that are at play in any irregular migration scenario. The one is the refugees themselves. The second is the coastal state authorities, here represented by the Coast Guard vessel. And then the third is the owner of the ship, who of course is responsible for the transit. And I'm going to add that there is a fourth stakeholder, and that is the flag state. So any registered vessel will have a national flag of origin, and the government that owns the flag that is flown from the ship also has rights and responsibilities on the high seas that importantly impact any particular case of irregular migration. So you have these stakeholders. Now, each one of them have rights and obligations of their own that crisscross one another in interesting ways, and in some ways that frustrate the application of humanitarian law when it comes to migration. And when we're thinking about how those obligations relate to one another, the first question we have to ask is, in which zone is activity taking place? So if a ship carrying asylum seekers has reached a point within 24 nautical miles of a coastal state, that is inside the contiguous zone, because the coastal state retains full authority to control migration and customs law in that zone, the coastal state or the Coast Guard that might be patrolling those waters has every authority to arrest, seize, interrupt, the vessel, its crew, any passengers, and even its cargo, with or without the authority of either the people driving the ship, the people in the ship, or the flag state. So in that zone, you have maximum jurisdiction to enforce any and all laws on the books in the coastal state. However, ironically, in the case of irregular migrants, it is also inside this zone, once you're in the national jurisdiction of a state, that people fleeing civil conflict, for example, can and do make refugee claims. And once a refugee claim is made by a person to a state authority, that creates obligations between the state authorities and the asylum seeker to consider that refugee claim. That is, to determine who is this person, where did this person come from, and does this person have a legitimate right to seek my protection from physical danger from their destination. So inside 24 nautical miles, the coastal state authorities have maximum ability to enforce their laws, and the migrant has maximum opportunity to demand protection from the coastal state. Now, there's obviously a natural tension there, because the coastal state is probably, especially if we're talking about large numbers of migrants, is seeking to push those large number of migrants out of their jurisdictions at the very same time that that they are finding it convenient and to enforce their national laws. So there's a mismatch in our governance instruments, in the sense that they do not recognize or take account of both the humanitarian dimension and the sovereignty dimension of crisis that is presented by large-scale migratory flows. Now, if, on the other hand, we move out of the national jurisdictions and a coastal authority encounters a vessel carrying irregular migrants out in the high seas, in some ways the coastal state has sort of gotten onto more safe ground, in the sense that they no longer have to accept refugee claims by an irregular migrant, because they're not in national jurisdiction. An irregular migrant out on the high seas might be there for transit, maybe passing a coastal state jurisdiction without the intent to enter, but they don't have grounds to make a refugee claim from the high seas, which of course is not the jurisdiction of any state, so they can't be seeking state protection. But on the other hand, the coastal state also does not have the authority to interrupt or inspect or certainly detain or arrest any vessel on the high seas, except in very unique circumstances, and importantly, except with the permission of the flag state. So the Coast Guard ship or warship, in some cases, that encounters a would-be smuggling vessel, for example, cannot board that vessel without the permission of the flag state. Now, sometimes it's easy to get that permission, sometimes it's hard, but it remains the case that the coastal state authority, fearing that a large shipment of migrants or trafficked persons into their jurisdiction is imminent, has really very few authorities that they can exercise to address that threat. So again, a mismatch in the instruments, where in the zone where the state has the fewest responsibilities, humanitarian responsibilities, is also the zone where the state has the fewest, the weakest jurisdiction to address a sovereignty concern if it arises. Okay, so some important definitions. And again, I've put these definitions, these are legal terms, and they're important when we're thinking about the instruments at play in irregular migration. I've put them into the two baskets we already discussed, which is security of the person and security of the state. So when we're thinking about migration as a humanitarian crisis, it's important to remember that there are specific definitions for refugee, for asylum seeker, and there's an important consideration always at play that we call non-refoulement. And I'll go over what that means. The second category is definitions related to security of the state. And when we're thinking about irregular migration at sea as it relates to a sovereignty crisis or a security threat, the important terms to bear in mind are freedom of navigation, exclusive flag jurisdiction, and the protective principle. And each of these definitions provide parameters for action for the coastal state authority. And I'll go over each quickly. So first, asylum seeker. An asylum seeker is
simply a person who is hoping to make a refugee claim, but whose circumstances haven't yet been determined by the authorities. A refugee is a person whose status has been determined, and it means that because of well-founded fears of violence or persecution based on their race, religion, nationality, or social or political group, is unwilling or unable to return to the location of habitual residence. Now that means that a person who's fleeing violence or the threat of violence doesn't necessarily need to be a citizen of that country. It just needs to be a person who has lived in that country for some period of time. And if it's the case that circumstances in their home or their habitual home have become too dangerous for them to live under, and then they can be classified as a refugee and demand protection from a neighboring or even far off state. And that definition and the rights associated with being classified as a refugee are set out in the Convention Relating to the Status of Refugees, which was written in 1951. Also in that convention is the principle of non-refoulement. Now, I talked about once you're identified and processed as a refugee, that means that coastal states or other states have a responsibility to provide protection to you. One of those protections is guarantee of non-refoulement, and that means that no state, once they've determined a person or several people's refugee status, is permitted to return those people to their home territories as long as their lives are threatened, whether they're threatened by political persecution by the authorities or whether they're threatened by general civil war. It is illegal for a receiving state to send everybody back to where they came from, so to speak, purely out of their own sovereignty concerns. And those obligations are set out very clearly in the convention, the Refugee Convention of 1951. And many people believe that that rule is not only a treaty law, but it's also a customary law. That is, everybody is bound by that obligation, whether or not they've signed the convention. Okay, so on the security of the state, what principles are important to bear in mind? Well, freedom of navigation. So on the high seas, as I mentioned when we talked about jurisdictions, the high seas are open to all states, whether you are coastal or landlocked. A vessel, and if a vessel is over a certain size, it is obligated to fly some flag of some country. And all vessels on the high seas are permitted to sail freely without interruption by the authorities of any other state. And that's guaranteed under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. The principle of exclusive flag jurisdiction holds that as those ships are transiting the high seas, and particularly if they're over a certain size and they are required to be registered and fly the flag of a state, that everything that happens on that ship, whether licit or illicit, falls under the jurisdiction of the flag state alone. That is, if a crime is being committed on the high seas by people sailing a vessel, that it's the responsibility of the flag state of that vessel to enforce their domestic laws on that vessel and the people on it. It is not up to coastal state authorities or foreign warships who happen to encounter that vessel. It is not their right or obligation to enforce the law. That right and obligation is given only to the flag state. The last legal principle, which is a principle more than a rule, it's widely recognized under customary international law, and it's often invoked in cases of irregular migration, is something known as the protective principle. And the protective principle is meant sort of as a caveat to both freedom of navigation and exclusive flag state jurisdiction. It recognizes that sometimes a threat to the state happens beyond 24 nautical miles, and sometimes a state has prior knowledge that a threat is headed their way. In those circumstances, under the protective principle, customary law allows, in some very narrow circumstances, that coastal authorities may want to go out past 24 nautical miles to preempt a threat that is headed in their direction. And it's generally recognized that in those instances where you can see a threat coming, that state authorities do have the right, some limited rights, to at least interrupt or dissuade threats before they reach their national jurisdictions. Now, how that plays out in practice in cases of irregular migration are that a warship may visit a ship thought to be carrying illicit cargo, for example, smuggled drugs or smuggled weapons or smuggled people, that they can visit those ships, they can inspect those ships, they can detain individuals on the ship for a limited period of time before turning their concerns to the flag state for law enforcement. But they cannot arrest those on board, and they cannot seize the material because none of that has reached their jurisdiction yet. So it provides the state, the coastal state, some tools without totally disregarding the vessel's right to navigate freely or the flag state's right to be the sole authority on board. So it's kind of a balancing mechanism intended to address the very real sovereignty concerns that can arise from the fact that the high seas are largely an area that remain, by design, ungoverned space. Okay, so what are we to do with these definitions? Well, as I mentioned, these principles are the ones that are primarily acting on all of those state parties to circumstances of irregular migration. So you have a variety of instruments that are intended to address the security of the person. That is, they're intended to make sure that refugees have rights, that people fleeing violence and persecution have some sanctuary in the international community. They're also meant to address the reality that people who are in distress at sea, if they're on an unseaworthy vessel or if they've hit bad weather, that they also have some rights vis-a-vis passing ships or coastal state authorities. And all of those instruments basically try to ensure that we minimize the loss of life at sea, either by accident or in the act of irregular migration. On the other hand, we have a variety of legal instruments that protect the security of the state and the integrity of the high seas. And some of the instruments, including the Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime, the Protocol on Migrant Smuggling, and the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, as well as some well-accepted customary principles, all address that reality that it is the state that is the primary actor in international affairs, and it is the state that is entitled to reasonable protection from threats coming from the high seas. The crisis of governance that I talked about earlier arises from the fact that a lot of those instruments intended to address the security of the person are declaratory instruments. That is, they are statements that the international community came together to make about the way we would like things to be. We would like refugees to have protections and sanctuary in the event of crisis in their home countries. On the other hand, all those principles related to the security of the state are really more reflective conventions about the way that states already behave and validating their concerns and their behaviors to address those threats to the state on which we can all agree. So in some ways you have high principles and declarations that are competing against sovereignty concerns that are already being addressed on a day-to-day basis by state authorities. And in a crisis of some kind that causes a large movement of people, these two bodies of laws don't match up very well. That is, coastal state authorities find it hard to both protect their sovereignty and address the very real humanitarian need to minimize loss of life. And that's why I call it kind of a crisis of governance. In a lot of ways, the instruments that we've designed for ourselves don't address the full range of concerns that come with the movement of a million people in the course of a calendar year, for example. And we still have quite a lot of work to do to make sure that the laws that we're operating under and the operations that we're putting in place to address all of our concerns are actually meeting all of our needs. Right now, we're heavily balanced towards prioritizing the security of the state, and we're not doing such a great job of living up to our own aspirational declarations of meeting humanitarian needs in particular areas of crisis. Okay, so I'm going to talk really quickly about three models. And like I said at the beginning, I certainly don't hold out any of these models as best practice. I'm not sure that as an international community we have any best practice on this issue, but I'm putting them out there just as examples that have some strengths and some weaknesses, but that are already operationalized in the maritime space. And all three of these models can be improved upon, should be improved upon, but they at least give us a place to start. And they are the best that coastal states have been able to come up with when presented with unexpected and unacceptable crises. So here's a list of the three that we'll consider. So first is what I call the cooperative model, and it's laid out by Frontex, which is the European Border and Coast Guard agency that was stood up by the European Union in the mid-2000s. It is a multinational agency tasked with reinforcing and streamlining cooperation border security on behalf of EU member states. I call it the cooperative model because it is cooperative along two axes. Obviously, it involves a heavy amount of coordination and cooperation between European countries themselves, particularly in this case by southern European countries, which are seen as the front lines of the irregular migration crisis of the Mediterranean. But it also involves cross-Mediterranean cooperation and coordination. So, for example, European states, including Spain and Italy, have signed bilateral treaties that are put into practice through and with Frontex with opposing shore countries like Libya, like Morocco, like Senegal, even in the case of Spain. And so there is a lot of cooperation, not just between European countries, but also capacity-building cooperation to try to ease the burden on the country or the sending country as well. Here are the Mediterranean migration routes once again, and so you can see who the major state players are and what their operating space looks like. Now, as a cooperative model, Frontex has evolved considerably over time as the irregular migration crisis itself has evolved. And I can identify in the timeline from 2006 into the present at least four strategic vectors. And each strategic vector lent itself to a different kind of operational response. So first, when Frontex was first set up, as I mentioned, it was set up to address primarily what was economic migration on the West African or Western Mediterranean route. The strategy that was adopted was really a dissuasion strategy. It was primarily focused on deterring the launch of migrants from West African and West Mediterranean countries like Mauritania, Senegal, and Cape Verde. The dissuasion strategy involved the turning back of boats, sometimes through the use of soft force or hard force, although there's not a lot of detail in the open in media and academic reporting on exactly what tactics were used. You can imagine that when coastal states authorities are trying to persuade small vessels to turn around, that it might include warning shots as well as direct communication to the ship. But the European approach was to dissuade boats if they were already at sea to try to convince them that it wasn't worth the risk to continue on to the coastal state. And before they left sea, there was a number of programs designed to encourage migrants to stay in their country of origin or, in some cases, to stay in Senegal, Mauritania, or Cape Verde as transit states. And those were primarily came in the form of development programs, of judicial programs, of policing programs that helped those, in the minds of the Europeans, helped those destination states get better at keeping people in their country and giving them some viable opportunities that would make the transit unnecessary in the first place. Now, as the numbers of migrants continued to increase despite this dissuasion strategy, starting in about 2009, Frontex evolved into what I called a search and rescue or diversion strategy. Now, the search and rescue strategy started to be focused on that central Mediterranean route, and you'll of course know that around 2009 was an important time in the Arab Spring, in activities and events in Tunisia, in Libya, as well as in Syria. And the diversion strategy had a much harder edge to it. It involved a greater commitment of resources, but it was also focused on safety of life at sea. So it did have a search and rescue flavor. Starting in 2014, 2015, when the volume of migrants transiting the Mediterranean really began to hit a crisis point, and of course the Kurdi photo that I showed at the beginning of the podcast happened in September of 2015, the state authorities really started to get serious about what their public was increasingly viewing as a humanitarian crisis and not just a disturbing trend. Now you remember with that terrible photo, I mean, the politics around migration in Europe at that time took on this very shrill tone that was outraged about the human cost of all of this movement across the Mediterranean in unconventional ways. But the states, plural, involved didn't respond necessarily in the way we might expect in terms of addressing the humanitarian concern. What they did was change their identification of the root cause or the driving factor behind all this loss of life. So state authorities very quickly said, yes, we agree this is a humanitarian crisis. We agree that there's unnecessary loss of life. And states are not responsible for this loss of life, but trafficking criminal organizations involved in human trafficking are preying upon these communities. They're taking money from these people and then sending them across the sea in very dangerous ways. And it's those criminal organizations which are responsible for the outrage that that we see, for example, in the Kurdi photo. As a result of framing events in that way, Frontex took a very law enforcement heavy strategy. It was intelligence led and it was designed to disrupt and dismantle criminal networks that were responsible for moving large amounts of people across the Mediterranean. They didn't see an immediate result from this shift, although there was some result. The numbers of people crossing the Mediterranean didn't really dramatically go down until 2016, when they not only kept this counter-trafficking kind of strategy in place, but they doubled down on it and militarized it and declared a war on smugglers. So NATO stood up an operation to support law enforcement in their campaign against transnational criminal networks. And the UN Security Council helped out by passing a resolution that allowed law enforcement or counter-trafficking activities to take place inside the territorial sea of Libya, which was at the time identified as one of the key destination countries. So between 2006 and 2018, we saw a very distinct mission evolution from starting from a soft dissuasion strategy that also was coupled with capacity building assistance from European states to African partners, all the way to this war on smugglers that had a very well-organized and thought-out military operational approach, which did end up being fairly effective in the sense that the numbers of people trying to get across the Mediterranean to reach Europe have declined dramatically since 2015. So obviously they have had a lot of success. What I will point out is that all of these mission objectives and operational responses have been very heavily focused on the sovereignty paradigm or the sovereignty crisis in some way, shape, or form. And none of them alone have been squarely confronting the humanitarian aspect of these large population flows. Okay, the second model that I'll go through is the offshoring model, I call it, which is the Australian response to similar concerns about large-scale refugee movements or migration movements, I shouldn't say refugee, but migration movements into Australia from a variety of different places in the Indian Ocean and in Southeast Asia. Operation Sovereign Borders is a whole of government initiative. It's supported by a wide range of federal government agencies and it focuses on three lines of effort. First is disruption and deterrence, which primarily happens out at sea. The second is detection, interception, and transfer, which also happens out at sea. And then the last is detention and removals, which is entirely handled by shore-based immigration and customs and border patrol personnel. Operation Sovereign Borders was established in 2013, although it does have its roots in activities that the Australian government undertook much earlier. So the next slide shows the data behind the operation. In the 1990s and culminating around 1999, 2000, Australia started to receive a large number, what the public saw as an unacceptably large number of boat people, people arriving from various locations around the Asia Pacific and making refugee claims in Australia. In response, and I think enabled by, in some ways, by the change in international politics that September 11th caused, the Australian government identified human trafficking and the potential terrorist or infiltration threat of boat people as a way to justify a very robust government response to push back anybody trying to reach Australian shores. Now, Australia is a member of the Refugee Convention, and they have never denied their obligations under the Refugee Convention. What they have said is that we, for reasons of national security, would prefer to process refugee claims outside of Australia rather than on Australian soil. So starting in 2001, the Royal Australian Navy began turnbacks, interceptions, which probably do involve some use of force, although again, those details aren't readily available to the public. And they also struck deals to open detention and processing centers with other partner countries, most notably with Nauru and Papua New Guinea. So the standard operation procedure was for the Australian Navy to divert boats, some cases tow boats or direct boats or the people on them to these detention centers in Nauru and PNG, where their refugee claims will be processed according to Australia's international obligations. The result of this was pretty dramatic, as you can see from the data. So around 2001, there was, you know, around 3,000 arrivals that were recorded. And in 2002, after the detention centers were opened and the interceptions began, there was a dramatic drop in the numbers. Around 2008, the detention centers were closed. They were seen as no longer necessary, and they were no longer as politically popular, arguably. And almost as soon as they closed, there was a dramatic uptake again in the number of irregular crossings headed to Australia that the authorities recorded. And this culminated in 2013, in a year when there were over 20,000 irregular arrivals in Australia, and again, arriving from a vast array of countries from different circumstances. And in 2013, of course, is when Operation Sovereign Borders was launched, the whole of government effort, and the detention centers were reopened. And again, we've seen a dramatic drop in the numbers. So what this tells us is that the Australian strategy has been incredibly successful at mounting credible deterrence. And the activities of not just the Navy, but the whole of government effort to process, to receive, and to process, and when necessary, repatriate would be asylum seekers offshore has been very effective from a national security perspective. There have, however, been some other problems, difficulties, some of which are procedural and some of which are political. So while the detention centers have addressed the threat to sovereignty and prevented people from landing on Australian shores, the post-assessment process has been a little bit messy and unclear. That is, once people have been processed, and many of them have, and if they're determined to not have legitimate grounds for a refugee claim, there's been a lack of clarity about what happens to those people next. People in PNG, for example, who have found not to be refugees, no longer have any basis to request access to Australia. But it's not clear who's going to pay for them to be repatriated or even where necessarily they should go next. Some of them have tried to stay in PNG, and there's been a lot of concern among the community about what that means in terms of its impact on the economy and its impact on the social fabric. So there's been a major diplomatic disruption between PNG and Australia as a result of these few thousand people, despite the fact that PNG has been compensated by Australia for the detention center itself. And in fact, earlier this year, the Supreme Court of Papua New Guinea closed the centers, although they've had difficulty actually doing that in practice because of all of these diplomatic challenges and procedural challenges.
there's also been a lot of political complications. The most well-reported one was between President Trump and Prime Minister Turnbull. As part of the closing of the PNG facilities, Australia sort of contacted some of its friends and allies in the international community to see if some of those people might be, who were determined to be refugees, might be resettled in other countries. Reportedly, President Obama had agreed to take a small number of these refugees. President Trump then decided in keeping with his campaign plan and the mandate that he received from the voting public, he refused to take those refugees to which President Obama had committed, and there was a famous initial phone call between President Trump and Prime Minister Turnbull that allegedly ended when the president hung up on him. But so there's been some political complications about what to do with these refugees once they have been processed and they are determined to have legitimate claims. Australia seems still unwilling to accept these refugees because of what it says the impact would be on its strategy of deterrence. If people feel like they can eventually reach Australia, it'll only encourage more transits and increase the threat to Australian sovereignty. So they've tried to outsource some of these determined refugees to partners and allies, but that has not gone smoothly in every case. Okay, the last model is what I call the safe transit model, and it involves the discovery of, in this case, in 2015, the discovery of up to 8,000 civilians in two separate vessels that were found listing or floating in the Bay of Bengal in May of that year. They were reportedly stranded. They were identified by the media as being Rohingya from Myanmar. And they appeared to be making preparations to make a refugee or an asylum seeker landing in some state, although their final destination was unclear. The immediate response by up to three navies in Southeast Asia was to treat this not necessarily as a humanitarian concern or not necessarily as a threat to state sovereignty, but to take something in between and to consider this as a search and rescue case. And so up to three navies reportedly provided these vessels water, food, and fuel to allow them to continue their transit to their destination with minimal threat to life. Now, that activity is entirely in keeping with the safety of life at sea provisions to which those countries are party, but were criticized by some as not addressing the humanitarian concern of these people stranded at sea. I'm not sure about the merits of that political concern. I can again say that by providing food, water, and fuel, those three coastal states were meeting their obligations and were at least temporarily guaranteeing the safety of all the passengers on their ship, even if it was leaving some questions unanswered. Their activities were entirely legal. But in the following month, the political pressure or political dissatisfaction with this kind of limited search and rescue type response got so intense that Malaysia and Indonesia did agree to bring these asylum seekers or bring these unidentified civilians ashore, and they launched a major search and rescue operation to make that possible. The deal that appeared to be struck with these two countries was that they would provide a location for these people to stay while their claims were being processed, and that the actual processing and all the costs involved would be taken care of by UN agencies. And as far as I know, this processing is still ongoing. Okay, so three models for maritime border security. Three different examples of how states or single states or groups of states are addressing this challenge. Again, I think what we can say is common to all three of the responses is that clearly irregular migration at sea is primarily dealt with as a sovereignty threat by all states. And that's despite the fact that we all acknowledge the humanitarian issues at play. My interpretation of this is that we as an international community are suffering from a governance crisis. We enjoy the high seas and the mobility that it provides, both for national security purposes and for the purposes of free and open international trade, which benefits all of us. But at the same time, the high seas as this open space, with the reality that occasionally land-based crises will drive people to sea in search of refuge, has challenged our governance frameworks. We recognize humanitarian concerns. We have a desire to minimize loss of life at sea. We've signed up to international treaties committing to provide safe haven for people in need of temporary shelter. But that doesn't match up very well with all the rights and responsibilities we've designed to protect state sovereignty. I don't think that was the intent, but that's been the result. And as long as we ignore this sort of asymmetry in our legal instruments and ignore the gaps that are left in the space between our humanitarian concerns and ambitions and our sovereignty concerns and fears, the more people will kind of be left in this nether space where their needs, their basic needs, aren't being met. In a lot of ways, we are not living up to our declared intent and our ambitions as they're set out in a lot of international instruments. And the challenge for us going forward as a regional community, as an international maritime community, is to design governance instruments which address all of our concerns, ranging from sovereignty to humanitarian. It's a very, very big challenge. It's one we haven't even started talking about as an international community, and it sets out a very clear challenge for us in the future.